brought to you by ConcordiaTheology.org, bringing you resources that support the vigorous life of the mind in service of the gospel of Christ.
Welcome to Lectionary Kickstart. We're sparking your thoughts for Sunday as you plan your sermon or teaching lesson. I'm your host, Jessica Bordalo, here with Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker. They're both professors of homiletics here at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. You can hear all about us in our introductory episode, but trust me, they're pretty good preachers. All right, let's get started. Peter, where are we in the church year?
We are in the 13th Sunday after Pentecost, the time of the year where we think about God's work by His Spirit through His church for the sake of the world.
And David, what are the texts for this week?
The texts for this week are Isaiah 51, Romans 11 through 12, and Matthew 16. Those can be found on our website.
As usual, each of you tell me which text you would pick to preach on, and then we talk more about that. But you never know who I'm going to ask first. And this time, it's David. David, which text would you preach on?
Good. Well, I'm going to preach on Matthew 16, I think. And this is one of those cases where the text is filled with so much stuff that you could preach.
Right.
And it's you can't cover it all.
Right.
Right. This is the kind of text that when I teach homiletics, I often give beginning preachers a text that has way too much in it.
Right.
And I'm saying, I'm going to teach you from the very beginning that you're going to have to, there are going to be, how did Fred Craddock put it? Fred Craddock said, there are very good, important Christian things that will not get said
that
on Sunday.
That will not be said
right.
in this sermon.
Yeah, I love that. So this text is just filled with a lot. But the one piece that kind of strikes me is what happens in the very beginning of the text. So Jessica, could you read verses 13 through 16?
Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God."
Okay, so this text has perhaps one of the clearest confessions of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. It's happening right at the end of his traveling section and right before he's going to journey into Jerusalem, where we will understand what it means for him to be the Christ, the Son of the living God, giving his life for all people. So it's right at that cusp of the turn in the Gospel of Matthew. But you have this really powerful confession of who Jesus is, but what is so surprising to me is where it happens. Where did it say that they went?
It says the district of Caesarea Philippi.
Right. So when I was in Israel, I remember we went up to that area.
Oh, you were in Israel?
Yeah, yeah. It was great. It was great. And we went up into that area. It is beautiful. It's green. It's lush. We had been down further toward Jerusalem. And so I was like, oh my gosh, there's water, right? There was like a waterfall. There's this spring thing that they would, you know, the guide at least tells you that people used to worship Pan here. So you've got this beautiful setting. It's kind of the beginning of the River Jordan up there in the north. And it's striking to me that in Matthew's gospel, I mean, if, you know, I would expect Jesus to be confessed as the Christ in the temple, right? Or in a synagogue someplace. But instead, I mean, and, you know, in Luke, you have that sermon in Nazareth, you know, I do speak to you, am he, right? Mm-hmm. But here in Matthew, the clearest confession of who Jesus is happens in a place that's furthest away from the temple. And it's out in the world, out among people who are not following Jesus, where that's where suddenly we get this strong confession of who he is. And I just love the fact that Jesus asked two questions. And I think those two questions are so simple, but those are two questions we could ask ourselves and we could ask one another. Who do people say I am? So in your people group, in your tribe or whatever, you know, who do people say Jesus is? Is he a great teacher? Is he, you know, some guy who's been, you know, a great liberator of the poor. Is, you know, who is Jesus? Is he creating social unrest? Is he this really sweet, sentimental, loving guy wearing white robes and having soft flowing brown hair? I mean, what, you know, what kind of, who is the Jesus that you know? And then, you know, so who do other people say Jesus is? And I think to myself, you know, if I approach people that way, you know, I think of my friend Margaret. If I approached her thinking, who does Margaret say Jesus is? There are people in my life that I'm not sure who they say Jesus is. And that would be kind of something I might want to know, right?
Yeah.
Who do people say I am? And then the second question is, and who do you say I am? And so right then you've got kind of now is an opportunity for me to make a personal confession of who Jesus is in this very, not in the temple, but out right. there in the world. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I like about it. I just think it's, I think it's an amazing opening to the text.
Yeah, and Peter's answer to that question, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, there's more than one way to answer that question rightly.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, so there's, I think about those two questions, and the first one are what some others say who really aren't right. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not John, he's not Elijah, he's not Jeremiah, he's not one of the other prophets. And so that would kind of get to kind of maybe misunderstandings of who Jesus is. And then Peter responds to the second question and gives a faithful answer. But it's not the only faithful answer. There's a lot of ways you can answer that question. You know, he's a good shepherd. He's a healer. He's the Alpha and the Omega. But yeah, I think those two questions, that those are, you know, those are really the only two questions that in the end ultimately matter.
I like that. Right.
And, yeah. And they're questions that everybody has to consider.
Right. And they're questions that, there are questions that if you took them with you wherever you went, they would bring you to the heart of the matter, whatever you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when you're at a group with people, a social group, and you stand there in your mind, who do they say Jesus is? Who do I say Jesus is? That will affect how you act in a situation. It will affect what you think you're doing and why you're here. And yeah, I don't know. I love those questions. So
well, it's, you know, it's worth noting that it's a plural you there. Who, mm-hmm. Who do you say that I am? Jesus said to them, who do you say? And Peter replied.
Right.
And so he's confessing their faith, which right. to me is kind of a helpful way to think about it. Anytime we answer for ourselves, we don't ever answer for only ourselves. We
right.
answer as part of
the church.
The church.
Right.
And we confess that together.
Yeah, and then the rest of the passage, I mean, so, you know, so that's kind of where I would probably focus my time, is thinking about that. But the rest of the passage has so much about, you know, who reveals this confession. God the Father does. And you've got that nice, you know, I'm going to build my church on this rock. And you've got those fun parallelisms of, you know, you are the Christ, you are Peter, son mm-hmm. of the living Father, son of Jonah, John, right? So you've mm-hmm. got kind of these parallelisms that are going on. And then there's that really odd, I don't know, this is a tangent that's probably not preachable, but in Bible class I might want to figure it out, is the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, right? So God's going to build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And I just don't, it's odd to me. How would gates prevail against the kingdom? I mean, it's not like the swords of hell or the guns of hell or the all of the war machinery of hell or the troops of hell, the gates. Well, how are gates going to, how would they prevail?
I wonder if that's like a, I mean, I don't know, I'd have to look it up, but I wonder if that's like a...
An idiom
for what comes out of the gates, like of a fortress
okay,
or something like that.
Okay, so the gates, I was wondering if it was kind of like Satan believes he has everybody locked in the gates of hell, and he ain't going to be able to keep them because God will call them out to be the church, right? So that was kind of, you know, I don't know, but it's just, it's a weird image to me.
It is. Yeah, it's one that we quote that all the time, but you don't think about
right.
it.
Right. Because I always think hell won't prevail against it, but it's actually the gates of hell. And I'm like, well, what?
I would prefer to not even get to the gates of hell. I would like that door to stay shut. So if that can't prevail, that's great.
Right, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
But that is a great promise. I mean, whatever the gates of hell means, one of the few promises that Jesus makes about what will last eternally is his church.
Right.
You know, this is the, I used to think when I was younger that your family will always, kind of the most stable thing in life that will endure no matter what is family, because, you know, you get older and, you know, kids leave home, but they're still part of the family. And so I used to think, well, family is really the one thing that'll last. But of course, we all know and experience in our own families ways in which that doesn't always last.
Right, yeah.
But the family of the church, the family of God, that we have as a guarantee that will endure. Mm-hmm. And especially in a day and age when the church is kind of under attack, or people feel at least like it is, that's pretty comforting, I think.
Yeah.
I have a question. So after Peter answers, Jesus' answer to him was, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Usually he calls him Peter. What does that mean?
Well, Simon Bar would be Hebrew for son, and I think it would be Simon, son of John, right, is kind of what you've got. So Jesus...
Even though it says Jonah, it means John?
Right, John.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, and so you've got Simon, son of John. And so I think the parallelism is Jesus is son of the living God. And Jesus is now saying to Peter, "Peter, son of John." I just like that. I think it's a nice, it's a nice exchange. I don't know what I would make of it in this sermon, but
whatever you make of that, have you heard Chuck Aaron talk about Peter's answer? "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God."
Mm-mm.
So he points out that in that answer, Peter brings together two narrative streams. There's "you are the Christ," that's the Messiah, the one sent
right.
to the people of Israel.
Right.
And kind of that tracks with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Son of the living God, that goes back to creation, the living God.
Oh.
And so you've got, you are the Christ for the people of Israel, the Son of the living God
for all people. Yeah.
And so you could, he likes to unpack that as kind of these dual, they come together, all people, all creation, and the people of Israel. In this one, from Peter.
So, what about you, Peter? Which text would you have picked?
This week, I was looking at Romans chapter 11.
Finally, somebody get back to Romans. I've been waiting two episodes for you to get back to picking Romans.
I know, and it's a great text in Romans.
It's a great text, and like we talked about a couple weeks ago, this text is in some ways easier because you've kind of gotten through the tough stuff in Romans 11. Which, if you noticed last week, it was another one of those chop-up verses.
Right, yeah. So not only do you have difficult topics, but you don't have the entire discussion of them.
And that's why some of these things, like Romans 11, is probably better for a Bible study,
mm-hmm.
unless you got a lot of time for a sermon.
Right, yeah.
Because there's just a lot to do. But Romans 11, 33 to 12, 8, that has a little bit more, there's a little bit more that's you can digest and unpack without spending so much time. So I was wondering, Jessica, I want to actually start in chapter 12. Would you read Romans 12, verses 1 to 3?
"I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. For by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned."
Okay, so Paul says that we should not think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. To me, this stood out because everything leading up to this section of Romans, Romans 11 was all about Israel. It's all about God's promises,
mm-hmm.
the elect, all this kind of stuff. He's talking about Israel to the Christians in Rome. And now in chapter 12, of course, the end of chapter 11 then is this kind of this doxology, just basically saying God's so far beyond us and above us, we kind of all we can do is praise him. And then in verse 1, he gets, okay, we've been talking about Israel. Now let's talk about you.
And
so he says, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers." He's inviting them to change their focus from the big picture plan of salvation
mm-hmm.
to their specific lives. And that line in verse 3, this, "do not think of himself more highly than he ought to think," that got me asking, well, how ought we to think of ourselves? If we shouldn't think more highly,
mm-hmm.
well, then How ought we to think of ourselves?
My 10-year-old was asking me that the other day. He said, if we're supposed to love our neighbors as ourselves, does that mean we're supposed to love ourselves best? Or should we should probably think bad about ourselves, right? Not love ourselves. It was this huge conversation about what does God mean by that and how should we think of ourselves? So give me an answer for my 10-year-old, Peter.
Well, no, what's interesting about that is you think about how much time we spend thinking about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Finding a picture to put on a profile.
Right. The time, and then you have to retake it like 16 times
to
make sure you get the lighting just perfect.
Yeah.
But you think about the existence of mirrors, how often we look at ourselves. We think about how much attention we put to the way we present ourselves,
mm-hmm.
Kind of the ever-present selfie. You know, one time I was at a meeting and they said, look and see, on your phones, sometimes they have they can categorize how many selfies you have on your phone. They break it down by different categories.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I was at this meeting and people were checking how many selfies they had just kind of to see how often do we take pictures of ourselves. And mine came up as the top.
No.
But here's the thing. It was because my tween-age daughter had linked her accounts with mine.
Oh.
So we were starting throwing through my selfies, and they were all of my daughter braiding her hair and putting on fancy dresses and that kind of stuff. So then I saved a little bit of face there. But this idea that we think so much about ourselves in this culture. We're a very narcissistic culture in that respect. And this text gives us an opportunity to think rightly of ourselves.
What happens if we think of ourselves more highly? We get offended more frequently. Right.
Yeah, we'll probably get offended more. We'll be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a professor on campus. Whenever I say to him, "Hi, how are you?" He's like, "Better than I deserve." I'm like, "Well, there we go." Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you think highly of yourself, you're like, I get offended more easily because you should treat me different. Yeah.
Yeah, and we also then have a hard time listening to other people. Because if we think highly of ourselves, that means our thoughts, our ideas,
mm-hmm.
we think highly of those as well.
Yeah, it would definitely determine how you would treat people who disagree with you,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
right. Yeah.
They're wrong.
Yeah, you want people to
end.
Value your opinion, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's think. So I'm thinking about the sermon, inviting the congregation to reflect on how we think of ourselves and how we ought to think of ourselves. And what strikes me about this text is a couple of things. One is, in this context, verse 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. So how does the world think of itself? How do people in the world think of themselves?
Well, I think you care about what I eat because I take pictures of it and post them.
That's right.
Right? So, right? I mean, look at your selfies,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see what the world has shaped you to think is important, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think of, so you could go kind of the...
So it's like a selfie test, right? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you could really make some hay with that, I think. I also think about the way the world is kind of self-serving.
Mm-hmm.
Autonomous, it always comes up with some sort of cultural issue or even some political issues. Who's in charge of me, and I need to be able to express myself. I determine who I am, even what I am sometimes. And so there's this autonomous self in charge. And can you think more highly of yourself than to think you are absolutely in charge of
everything? Right.
You can be, though. You can control what ads come up on your mm-hmm. Facebook. And you can pick which music you listen to, which news source you get your news from. You can make your world as little and as just like you as you want.
Yeah, and that's we do that without even thinking about it.
Well, that's another way of thinking highly of yourself, right, is that the most important thing is to care for you.
Are we talking almost like only or
right.
primarily
right.
or
yeah.
exclusively or predominantly? The highly, and maybe it's just an adverb.
And the contrast is sober judgment, right? So you've got sober judgment and high judgment, right? Thinking highly versus
with
having
sober judgment. According to the measure of faith God has assigned. So you back up just a little bit then. So how does the world think of itself? We've kind of been reflecting on that.
Mm-hmm.
How ought you to think of yourself? Well, that takes us back to verse 1. Would you read verse 1 one more time, Jessica?
I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship.
So I'm thinking about being an embodied creature, right? We can't think of ourselves apart from our bodies. And so as we think about ourselves rightly. Well, who are we? What are our bodies? And Paul here is talking about our bodies are living sacrifices. We present our bodies in sacrificial love, I think you could say, to others. That's kind of what the end of the verse gets at. You use your whatever gifts you've been given, you use that to serve others. Yeah. Well, that reversal, that contrast, and frankly, that kind of sometimes we wonder what worth our lives are.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of people who sometimes wonder what value they have. And in a way, Paul's saying you and your body have great value as a living sacrifice, as one who presents himself or herself for the sake of others. And so this bodies, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. But then Paul returns to the body in verse 5. Would you read, 4 and 5. Would you read 4 and 5, Jessica?
For as in one body we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function. So we, though many, are one body in Christ, and individually members one of another.
So you've got Paul saying, present your bodies as living sacrifice, and your bodies are members of one body, and this body in Christ, where we don't have this, we're not the same. We are kind of this, the idea that Christians are all kind of a cookie cutter.
Right,
That's not at all what he's talking about here. We're all members of one body, but we have very different gifts. And so whatever gift you have, and I think, you know, it's interesting, you look at the lists of gifts in the New Testament, especially in the epistles, Paul multiple times talks about the various gifts.
And they're different.
And they're different lists,
right.
Which I think is kind of nice because it's not like these are exhaustive gifts.
Right.
Paul's just kind of saying,
these are suggestive.
If this is the gift you've been given, then use it this way. If this is the gift you've been given, but the whole concept is your body, your life is a gift to others. In a way, that's a living sacrifice to serve others.
So Peter, then, how would you answer my son's question? Remember, my 10-year-old said, so we're no good, right? We're supposed to think that we're no good so that others are better. But then how are we supposed to love others like ourselves, because you're not supposed to love yourselves? How would you have answered him?
Well, I think in verse 2, it talks about not conforming to the world. So you want to help people guard against how the world would answer that question. But then the second half of that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And so what is the will of God then? Well, God willed to make you. He values you as a creature, as one who has been formed by him. And he is one who has made you good and acceptable and even perfect. If you want to take that language. Now, that's not exactly what Paul's saying there, so you'd be just using language to use it to describe who he is. But so your son is good, he's acceptable, and he's perfect because that's God's will for him, to make him as he should be, to remake him as he should be. Yeah, he's valuable to God, and he's useful to others. So properly thinking of yourself, how should we think of ourselves? We should think of ourselves as valuable to God and useful to others based on the gifts that he's given us.
That's all for today. We have free resources to guide your next step in planning at concordiatheology.org. You can find more episodes of this show on Spotify, Google, Apple. If you'd like to see the show continue, please subscribe, share, leave a review. I'm your host and producer, Jessica Bordolo. Join us next week here at Lectionary Kickstart when Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker spark your thoughts for next Sunday.
I was at this meeting and people were checking how many selfies they had, just kind of to see how often we take pictures of ourselves. And mine came up as like the top.
No. Well, I think you care about what I eat because I take pictures of it and post them.
That's right.
Right?